I joined Facebook very early. It was 13 years for me. So I was one of the first 10 employees there. And now we've got a lot of employees, but the maintaining that cultural DNA has been really important to us. All right, welcome back or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, I'm a sport and performance psychologist, as well as the co-founder of Compete to Create. And my partner in that business is head coach Pete Carroll for the Seattle Seahawks. And the business is based on the insights and the practices that we've come to learn to help people who want to be their best, how to condition and train their mind to do just that. Now, the conversations in this podcast, the whole idea behind it is to learn from people who are on the path of mastery. We want to better understand what they're searching for, how they organize their life, both internally and externally. And we want to understand the mental skills that they've used to build and refine their craft. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Facet. When we think about what it takes to thrive and to live a life of flourishing, there's no doubt that financial wellness is a big part of that equation. There's lots of ways to manage your money. And here's one that you might be interested in. Facet is the next generation of personalized financial planning. They're on a mission to make expert financial advice accessible to the masses. So Facet provides you with flexible access to a team of financial planners and a team of experts across retirement planning, tax strategy, estate planning, and more. And the best part here is that instead of taking a percentage of your portfolio, Facet only charges an affordable flat membership fee and doesn't charge you to invest with them. This is extremely rare for the industry. As you probably know, most financial advisors charge you a percentage of your assets. And even if it's only 1%, those fees can really add up over the course of your lifetime. And because you're listening to this podcast, Facet is hooking you up with a great offer. When you sign up today, Facet will waive the $250 enrollment fee for new annual members. And they have an epic limited time offer on top of that. To learn more, just head to facet.com/FM. Again, this one is a little different. That's Facet, facet.com/FM to waive your enrollment fee and to learn more about their limited time offer. A little disclosure here. Facet Wealth Inc., Facet, is an SEC registered investment advisor headquartered in Baltimore, Maryland. This is not an offer to sell securities or investment, financial, legal, or tax advice. Past performance is not a guarantee of future performance. Terms and conditions apply. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Bubs Naturals. Like you, I am mindful about what I put into my body. So for me, it usually comes down to ingredients and simplicity. The shorter the list, the better. And that's why I've been loving Bubs Naturals. Bubs creates products with high quality, all natural ingredients that are designed to help us get after the adventures in life. For years, I've been a huge fan of their Hydrate or Die electrolyte mix. I mean, that's a fun title for a product, isn't it? It only has 6 total ingredients. It's packed with electrolytes. I love the taste. No added sugar, no artificial flavors, none of that stuff. It's great for post-workout recovery. That's when I use it. And I also use it during long periods of travel, which I've been doing a lot lately. And so thank you for the hydration here. And a ton of athletes that I know swear by them too. They're currently in just about every MLB locker room. They work closely with the Red Sox, the Yankees, I know the Rangers, Cardinals, Diamondbacks, and many more, of course. I'd love for you to go check them out. I think they're doing a really nice job. Just head to bubsnaturals.com/findingmastery and enter the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout for 20% off your first purchase. Again, that's Bubs Naturals, bubsnaturals.com/findingmastery with the code FINDINGMASTERY for 20% off your first purchase. Now, this week's conversation is with Matt Jacobson. He's the head of market development at Facebook. And in this role, he focuses on strategic partnerships that connect people to some of the world's most recognized brands. And Facebook might be one of the world's largest companies today, but it wasn't that way when Matt joined as employee number 8, and that was 13 years ago. He took a leap of faith at that time. He believed in their mission and the founder, Mark Zuckerberg, obviously, and he began working for no salary, only equity. You could say that that paid off. And what gave Matt the confidence to join Facebook? Like, what was that? What did he see and spot? And what allowed him to take that risk? That's what this conversation's about. His insights are real and they're rich, and he is deep and thoughtful and fun. And this conversation, we jump right down into the core of his intellectual curiosity that's allowed him to stay ahead of the curve, to take risks, and to open up new ventures and opportunities to capture those ideas both in his head and business-wise. So Matt clearly understands values, and he invests deeply in relationships. So it's no surprise that his philosophy, flat out, is to be the best part of another person's day. How cool is that? Isn't that a great thought? That his mission, his guiding principle in his life, is to be the best part of another person's day. So with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Matt Jacobson. Matt, how are you?
Great. Happy to be here.
Yeah. I'm ecstatic that you're here. Like, so context for how we first met is that we ended up having a breakfast together.
Right.
And it was awesome. It was a great conversation. And I couldn't believe how you've come to do what you've done and the places you've been and the influence you've had. And then our common affinity for surf and the surf brands and all that good stuff. So there was just so much to talk about that I wanted to open this up.
Yeah, no, it's humbling. I mean, the list of your people you've talked to is impressive. So, and we share all these weird life hacks too. So that we didn't know about before we had breakfast.
So. Okay, cool. So what is the best way for us to capture your history? And so I want to say this really succinctly is what would be useful for me to best understand you?
You know, I think, you know, my story is I'm a third generation Southern Californian. I grew up in Manhattan Beach. I raised my two kids in Manhattan Beach. I've just graduated from college, my twin daughters. I probably, if I was going to define myself, would be kind of surfer first, right? I think mm-hmm. that's probably the way you'd probably define me first. And, you know, I've been blessed with a great career. I had a very, you know, kind of went to UCLA, got out of school, wanted to work in the television business and started in the advertising side and kind of progressed. And so that's how it all started. And just kind of, it's been a bit of a jungle gym, but fun.
Brothers and sisters?
No, I'm only child.
Only child. Mm-hmm. Okay. Like, I want to talk about that because my son is an only child as well. What are some things that I should be aware of?
No, I think living at the beach, growing up in Manhattan Beach in the 60s and 70s, you know, it was kind of a rugby scrum anyhow. Like you were never kind of alone, you know? And I think that like this, there are no more free range kids. And we were kind of free range kids then, you know, we all kind of worked as a pack and ran around as a pack. And that started as little kids surfing when we were, you know, 9, 10 years old, being at the beach all day long, you know? And so I always felt like I had, you know, a group of friends that were always around. I think it may be more difficult now or just different in general. Cause I just don't see like, you know, when was the last time you saw a kid playing baseball, not in a uniform?
Mm-mm.
Right. And like that,
or even on the sidewalk or in the street or like, you know, it doesn't happen like
that. We were, you know, kind of just feral and that was the way Manhattan Beach was, you know, in the summer. And
so how did your parents get there?
My parents grew up in Venice. They were beach people. They, you know, loved the beach. My dad was a volleyball player and surfer. My mom was too. And they moved to Manhattan Beach, you know, in the 50s after they graduated. My dad got out of the Korean War, graduated from UCLA with my mom. And moved to Manhattan Beach because it reminded them of the way Venice used to be because they grew up on the oceanfront in Venice.
So they were a bit counterculture. They saw the world just a little different.
Yeah, well, I mean, Venice was not a counter. Venice of the 50s is not Venice of the 70s.
What was it like back then?
It was, you know, if you know this, the history of Venice was, you know, a lot of people moved to Venice from LA proper to avoid kind of the polio epidemic because living near the ocean was considered to be a healthier place to be. So it was the idea of sea air. And Abbot Kinney, for which the street is named, was the original developer of Venice and built Venice to look like Venice, Italy. That's where the canals, you know, off of Washington. So, but Venice was, you know, it was a suburb of LA proper near the beach that you had great access to because the red car was running then. And so access back and forth from LA to the beach was pretty easy.
What's the red van?
The red car was the original streetcar. Remember Who Framed Roger Rabbit? So yeah,
really?
Yeah. So public transportation was a... Okay. It's really good. Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a really good history of transportation in L.A., the same way Chinatown, you know, the movie mm-hmm. was as well, and understanding how, you know, public transportation existed in L.A.
Okay. With your deep roots and influential roots in tech, how do you know about transportation? Like, why is that?
No, I should probably say, you know, defining who I am, I should say Los Angelino, because I love Los Angeles. I love Southern California. And the history of Southern California has been part of my family, you know, for forever.
So sometimes LA gets a bad rap, right? And a lack of authenticity, moving and shaking, Hollywood, the surface, probably silicone implant, you know, capital of the world. I think here, Rio and San Diego, Orange County, like, you know, so how do you speak back to some of those traditional stereotypes?
I mean, I think LA is, you know, LA is not a place. It's a, you know, a conglomeration of places. And I think it's a powerful place. And I think if you talk to people who are not in Southern California about Southern California, it has magical, it's Oz, right? And people think of it that way. And I think that California in general gets a bad rap. And I think, you know, I was lucky to spend some time with Gavin Newsom, who's running for governor. And, you know, he was saying, you know, on Saturday night that, you know, the values of California are important and they're potent. And we shouldn't kind of, you know, shirk the, you know, this kind of great vibe of an economy that's the fifth biggest in the world, that has unbelievable opportunity, you know, and a lifestyle that is pretty unequaled.
Mm, okay. So how do you get into UCLA?
So my parents both went to UCLA.
Okay.
I applied kind of everywhere and, you know, was always kind of a Bruin at heart and got into other schools and places that I thought, well, were going to be dream schools. And I ended up at UCLA and loved it.
What'd you learn? I want to go back one step. What'd you learn in high school? If there's one or two things that you learned in the high school years.
Yeah, I guess I was and I'm not as avid a reader as I used to be, but I was a pretty voracious reader in high school.
So you learned the value, the love of
learning. Yeah, the love of the written word and books and learning. And I was in, you know, all through public school in Manhattan Beach, and, you know, being smart was cool then. And I don't know I don't know. I don't feel like I think the world is different. We can talk about that, but I think that being smart was cool and there was nothing to be, you know, embarrassed about, and kind of having knowledge and being smart and being intellectually curious. And I think that's probably the biggest lesson I learned. And it's funny because yesterday I got a call from my first grade teacher. And Lucy Tommy, who, you know, she was not only my first grade teacher at Grandview School in Manhattan Beach, but also my daughter Camille's first grade teacher. So, I mean, those kind of roots of staying in touch. I mean, she's like was really, you know, really, really important part of my life. I mean, I cannot pick up a pair of scissors today and think about like walking, holding the scissors the proper way that Mrs. E. Tommy taught me to when I was 5 years old.
Which, what, is it like you hang the on outside to, yeah, you and hang the tip is down?
Tip is down.
Yeah, and you pass it with
don't
the handle.
Don't run with scissors, right? But
it's funny because my son is 9, and the other day he grabbed the scissors, and the care that he had to carry those scissors, like I've never seen it like that before. But I do remember when I was like your age, I didn't have maybe such a crisp memory, but I remember like people yelling, like, no, don't hand us scissors that way. It was like, it was a different experience than what you had.
Teachers have had big impact on me. You know, I have like, you know, in grammar school, in junior high, in high school here, there were moments and teachers that I think are really important. And it's been interesting because I've been hosting these series of chats at Facebook, these icons and images series for the last 3 years. And it's interesting the through line, you know, I talked to Tony Robbins, and Tony Robbins will tell you that when he was in high school, it was a high school forensics teacher who encouraged him to take up public speaking. He had no interest. There was a girl in the class that he liked, you know, and that's how he started public speaking. Alan Hughes, who directed The Defiant Ones for HBO with, made Menace to Society when he was 19 with his brother, which is a pretty heavy movie. Mm-hmm. You know, he was in school, you know, in a suburb of LA, and was encouraged by a video teacher to say, listen, you've got a talent here. You should do this. Lena Waithe, I interviewed, who's, you know, an amazing Emmy Award winner, the first African-American woman to win an Emmy Award for comedy writing. It was a fifth grade teacher who said, wow, I really, on the south side of Chicago, he said, I really like the way you write because it sounds like you. And, you know, these are these like inflection point moments for people. And I didn't have one as poignant as any of those. But, you know, I respected learning and cared about learning and cared what my teachers cared about.
So following that thread, is there, it's said that people and experiences shape our lives. And so are there people or a person that has shaped your life, or has it been more experiential?
No, my parents are, you know, were unbelievable influences, you know, for me. My father was an amazing guy. You know, he, you know, again, a beach guy, you know, every day come home, get in the water. He was a great body surfer and surfer, you know, but he was a coat and tie guy every day. He was a very preppy Brooks Brothers guy. And like, that's kind of what inspired me. And we can talk about that.
That is you.
Yeah, that's me.
Right. So love of the water. And then, I mean, look, yeah. You're dressed to the nines.
Yeah, no, that's his thing. And I remember, you know, being with him, we went to, you know, he was a big UCLA fan. I remember going up to San Francisco with him as a kid, and we went to, I guess it was the Cal game, and we were in the city, and he was in San Francisco, and he was wearing a sport coat without a tie, and he goes, man, I just don't feel right. I remember going with him to J Press and buying a tie, and like, and there are moments like that. I feel too, like, you know, like, I kind of, I don't have a tie on, like, I feel.
So you're legendary for a lot of reasons, but one of the stories that you share with me was how you fit in at Facebook.
It's a lonely vigil, as I told you. But you know, listen, I joined Facebook very early. It was 13 years for me. So June 15th was we actually celebrate our faceversaries at Facebook, which is pretty great. I don't know any other company that does that. So we celebrate our anniversaries there.
When you join the company?
When you join the company.
So you're 13 years on?
I have 13 years at Facebook.
And how old is Facebook?
About 14 years. So I was early, you know, one of the first 10 employees there. And now we've got a lot of employees. But, you know, the maintaining that cultural DNA has been really important to us. But, you know, I met Mark. Mark, you know, I was in my mid-40s, and Mark was 19, 20 when I first met him. And I had come out of the surf industry. I had been working at Quiksilver, you know, running marketing services there and starting the entertainment division there. And, you know, I had spent, you know, 5 years of wearing ironic T-shirts and board shorts, and I just realized like that wasn't me. I'd worked in Hollywood for most of my career at 20th Century Fox and at News Corp, and went to Quick and that was not a coat and tie place. And when I got back to Facebook, I thought, you know, this is kind of serious business here. If we're going to make this go, I'm going to take it seriously. And I'm too old to wear ironic T-shirts. So
are you the only one wearing a suit and tie?
Oh yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. There's a tie Tuesday. So guys do wear ties on Tuesday sometimes. So kind of like casual Friday, there was a tie Tuesday. So.
What was the story you told me that you were walking around and people always thought you were a visitor?
Oh yeah. Security. I was like, you know, where's your badge? You know, like, who are you with? I mean, no, I've been here for a long time.
So. I'm actually, yeah. Yeah. employee, whatever. Yeah. Okay. So let's keep going backwards a little bit though. So then I want to go right before high school. What'd you learn in that phase? What were the important gems, nuggets, or insights that you look back on that were important to you?
Yeah, I think, listen, I learned this love of the beach. I mean, the beach has been kind of everything to me for, you know, since I was as long as I can remember. I mean, that's where all my great memories are, always at the beach. And so,
you know, is there one particular moment in time that stands out for you?
I mean, you know, I'm blessed because I live like on a typical Saturday now, you know, I live like I did when I was 10 years old. You know, I go down and surf in the morning, lay in the sand, play some volleyball, surf some more, you know, so I'm lucky I've been able to live like that. But, you know, listen, there are waves I remember, you know, when I was 11 years old and a guy who mattered to me said, wow, great wave. Like, so like there's moments like that, but no, the beach has been kind of everything. I think the thing that I learned, and kind of back to your question about being an only child, is the beach is an unbelievable kind of leveler. It's kind of, you know, when you're at the beach and you're in a pair of board shorts, whether you're 9 years old or in your 50s, you know, everybody's kind of equal. You earn your waves, you earn your way on the court. It doesn't matter who you are. And that was a lesson that I learned. It's, you know, the beach is a real meritocracy.
It really is. Certainly out in the water is, yeah. Because, and even if you're in the right position, let's say you get lucky, right? And you're in the right position, you get a wave and you're out of sync with the wave. you're ejected.
Yeah. No, and yeah. Listen, and you know, it's that first way. Listen, I'm lucky that I surf. I live pretty much where I grew up. So I surf with some of the same guys I started surfing with when I was, you know, 8, 9 years old. And so like I know between 15th Street and Marine Street in Manhattan Beach, like I know that, you know, that 150, 200 yards, right? You still have to earn your way. I mean, it doesn't matter who, if I surfed there forever, it's not like a big local scene in Manhattan, but if you're a kook and, you know, you blow a wave, you know, you got to kind of earn your way back in.
You might not get another wave that session. All right. So growing up, only child in the same neighborhood as the ancestry that, you know, from the Los Angeles family crew that you came from. And then you fell in love with learning. That's kind of the high school phases. And then, so college, what are the big takeaways from the college years?
No, college was great. You know, I've told my daughters who have just graduated, I have a daughter who is a dancer who graduated from Juilliard a year ago, and her twin sister graduated from Harvard last month.
I told Juilliard them stay, and Harvard. Yeah, so hold on.
They're good
kids. How does
that
happen?
Yeah. From, you know, Manhattan Beach kids, right? So pretty great.
So what were some of the takeaways? Because those are two of the finest schools in the world.
Yeah, listen, I mean, back to kind of like what, you know, I thought college is like, I realized that college is the last time anybody really cares how you're doing. So I've encouraged them to stay as long as possible in school. But, you know, I loved it. I thought, wow, I found things that I was interested in. I studied architectural history because there was a great professor there, Tom Hines, who was really the historian on Neutra and Burnham. So kind of like the Burnham movement in Chicago to Neutra, like before anybody really cared. I'm old, so no one really cared about modernism, you know, in the early 80s. And then I, you know, weirdly studied Japanese politics because there was an unbelievable professor named Hans Berwald, who I just read passed away, who had worked in Japan after the war, writing the Japanese constitution, which was very, as a young man. So very, and if you look at the Japanese constitution, it basically is what the US constitution would be if you had 150 years of experience, what you would do better. Coalition government, you know, it's a really good learning zone. I said, wow, here's a chance to learn from a guy who was there kind of writing it. So for me, college was interesting because of the serendipity of finding two great, you know, professors, you know, in their disciplines, you know, both architectural history and political science. And that was inspiring to me.
And then what did you do to support your daughters? Like, was she interested in dance?
Yeah, my daughters have been dancers since they were 5 years old.
And so you guys didn't shape that in any way?
No, they discovered dance.
It doesn't feel that way.
And they discovered dance at an early age and loved it. And I feel really lucky because they're petite and they weren't going to be volleyball players from Manhattan Beach. They weren't going to be lacrosse players or soccer. They were those kids that were like, you know, would run away from the ball in soccer, you know, and they found dance and the esprit de corps of being part of a dance company, a traditional ballet company, was really important to them. And I think really shaped them as young women in terms of a sense of responsibility of the esprit de corps, of being part of something. And my daughter Daisy decided, you know, that she was going to make that her vocation. And my daughter Cammie said, you know, I love dance, but it's going to be my avocation. It's not going to be my vocation.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by UCAN. One important way to take control of your metabolic fitness is to fuel with foods that help regulate your blood sugar. It's key for your metabolism to work effectively and to maintain sustainable energy levels. So many sports drinks and energy products are filled with sugar or fast-digesting carbs. And while those give you a quick flash of energy, it ends up being short-lived and can lead to a crash. UCAN has taken a different approach, and that's why they're loved by so many elite athletes that I know. Their products deliver a sustained release of long-lasting energy that helps you maintain sharper focus, curb hunger cravings, to help you exercise harder without spiking blood sugar. They've developed a patent low-glycemic carbohydrate called Live Steady. It's derived from a complex starch instead of sugar, and its efficacy is backed by extensive research and clinical trials, which I know you love. A few members of the team here at Finding Mastery use UCAN on a regular basis while preparing for marathons and other endurance events, and they've loved it too. They say it's a game changer in their training and performance. Whether you're an intense exerciser or recreationally active or just looking for an energy boost to get you through the day, I hope that you'll consider checking out UCAN as a smarter way to fuel. You can try a variety of UCAN products for free when you head to ucan.co/findingmastery. You just pay for shipping. They'll cover the rest. Again, that's UCAN, spelt UCAN.co/findingmastery to try a selection of UCAN products for free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. I am really excited about what Apollo Neuro is building. If you haven't had the chance yet, I highly recommend that you go check out the conversation I had with their co-founder, Dr. David Rabin, on the podcast. It is well worth a listen. Unlike traditional wearables that simply track your biometrics, Apollo is doing it totally differently. Apollo Neuro is designed to actively improve your health by enhancing sleep, relaxation, energy, and focus. So how's it work? Developed by neuroscientists and physicians, Apollo delivers these soothing little vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, that are like music your body can feel. More rapid vibrations help to improve your energy and focus, while the slower vibrations help to promote rest and digest in your body. And the best part for me, they're grounded in good science. Apollo has been tested by thousands of users in clinical and real-world trials. I would love for you to give it a go. It's making a meaningful difference in my life. And because you're listening to this podcast, you can receive an exclusive 15% off an Apollo wearable. Just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer. It's only for us here at Finding Mastery. So be sure to use the code at checkout. Again, that's Apollo, APOLLO, Apollo Neuro, NEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. Okay, so let's fast forward to you're successful, and then you tell me about the success you had early before Facebook, because this was a little bit of a challenging decision, I would imagine.
Yeah, I had a great career. You know, I worked for great companies. I worked for great people. I worked for, you know, I was at News Corp and Fox for, you know, really exciting time. And I worked at Disney very early in my career when I got out of school. Like this transition of Disney from a family company to kind of the Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg era. That was like my first real, you know, studio job. I transitioned from there to Fox, you know, right around the time the Fox network was starting. So we got to be part, you know, in the room with Barry Diller and John Dolgen and people like that. And, you know, so that, like, I had a great career. And then I stayed at News Corp for a long time and ended up working, you know, James Murdoch was my intern for a summer, and then I ended up working for him and, you know, maintained a really great friendship with him and his family. And it was a really great opportunity. I had a really great and blessed career. And, you know, at Disney and Fox and then working on technology stuff early, really early days, starting in the early 90s at News Corp for Mr. Murdoch. And you know, from then got very interested in kind of what opportunities were and kind of stayed, you know, before it was fashionable.
What did you learn from a legendary Murdoch?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think that, you know, he takes a very pure information stream from, you know, a very limited number of people who are either related to him or have worked with him for a long time, and he's built an unbelievable trust for the people, you know, that, you know, around him for a long time. And it was an amazing, it'll change now with the sale of Fox, but, you know, it was an amazing family business. And if you embrace that and realize that you weren't going to run that company, it was the least political place you could be, because as long as you were, you know, realize that, you know, my job for a long time was to jump on hand grenades for people like James. But, you know, the ability to do a variety of things and learn a variety of stuff without worrying about, like, the politics or the jiu-jitsu of, you know, kind of, what, how am I going to get ahead? Because you're not going to – that's their company. So it's like a big hardware store that happens to be a giant media company.
Look at that.
But that's, like, unbelievably empowering, because Hollywood is generally not that way. It's super political. And I remember a guy told me early in my career that in Hollywood you don't hope for your friends to fail. You hope for your friends to die. And I think that, you know, that's probably true. And there's a lot of Schadenfreude in Hollywood.
What's the phrase?
Schadenfreude. You kind of hope for other people to fail.
Oh, wow. And you know what? I've never – is that – German?
Yeah, that's a thing. It's a German expression about, you know, it is. It's like the kind of hope for people you know to fail. Huh. And, you know, News Corp and Fox at that time was very much about, wow, you know, you want to explore some other things that you want to work on, as long as you kind of stick to the stuff that you're doing, if you want to explore it. I was given great opportunities by Chase Carey, who now runs Formula One, that kind of embraced, they thought, you know, it was wacky, the stuff I was talking about with technology, but allowed me to pursue that, before it was fashionable.
Is part of your way is to see forward, to see the future of what is either intriguing or interesting or trends that are coming? Is that part of it? Or because you were ahead at Facebook, you're definitely ahead. You're ahead at you know, well, maybe not Birdwell, but making it something special again, maybe.
Yeah, I think intellectual curiosity, it's kind of back to that. Like, yeah. I always want, I mean, like, okay. You know, I'm interested in, like, you know, kind of solving, you know, equations and learning new stuff. And like, I'm, you know, again, if I'm not, I feel like, you know, I'm not living up to my full potential.
Okay, so then how do you make that decision to go to Facebook?
So I was, you know, I was leaving Quicksilver after 5 years of starting the entertainment division there. It was time to kind of take on, you know, do something else. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And it ended up being that time Quicksilver had been growing really fast and was, you know, ended up making some dough. But it wasn't like I was not going to have to work again, but I didn't have the pressure of having to kind of find something right away. Mm-hmm. And complete serendipity through a mutual friend, was introduced to Mark, asked me, hey, there's this thing Facebook. I said, well, I know of it because of the marketing stuff we were doing. This is early days, you know, at Facebook, but Quicksilver, we're kind of obviously on our radar. And it was a college only site at the time, not even on all US college campuses.
So you knew about Facebook while working at Quicksilver?
Yeah, because you heard about it, like it was part of the zeitgeist. Yeah. But again, incredibly small compared to MySpace and Friendster, which were the kind of leading social networks at the time. And I met Mark and, you know, believed in him and a vision and mission that he had, which to make the world more open and connected and bring people closer together by doing that. And that was, I mean, when the first time I talked to him in spring of 2005, it was like, I want to build tools to, you know, make the world more connected and bring people together. And that's been
so
a consistent.
So he had that long.
That was his vision from the beginning.
At a school?
Yeah. No. That was his vision. And, you know, I loved that he was committed to that, and I felt like this is the kind of place I wanted to take a chance. And it was interesting because I chose to, you know, the company hadn't been kind of fully formed or, you know, at the time, and I wasn't going to move to Northern California. I'm a native Southern Californian, and, you know, my kids were 10 years old at the time, and so I wasn't going to move. And, you know, it was a company with seven other people there who were all recently out of, you know, college, or had kind of left college early and were in their late teens or early 20s. And, you know, I had a long resume because I was old. I was, you know, more than twice as old as Mark. And it was kind of became this thing, like, how are we going to pay you? And I said, I believe in what's going on here. And, you know, I'm at a place where, you know, and money has never been the most important thing to me. And I believe in kind of what we're trying to do. I don't really understand what the business opportunity is yet, but don't pay me. Let's try it for 6 months and we'll know in 6 weeks if it works or not. I'll work for equity. And it wasn't that I was so cunning, right? It wasn't that I said, well, this is this opportunity to kind of go graze in the vault. You know, it was just the opportunity to be part of something without, when you take money off the table and you can just, I said, listen, I'm going to see if there's a business, like if I can figure out if there's a business here, you know, I'm not going to bother you with that. And like, I'll report back when things happen. And that's how we started. It was no pressure on him, really no pressure on me. And it was this great freedom to kind of, you know, at the very early days was become an amazing company to be part of it.
And was that 6 weeks to 6 months, what were you looking for?
To see what the business opportunity was, you know, with, you know, how, you know, how will this scale? Can you build an ad business on this? Can we, you know, at the time ad deals were very small could you scale, you know, we didn't have the infrastructure to do thousands of deals that were small. So the goal was to find a couple of bigger deals to work on.
Then what were some of the decisions that you grappled with as an early employee that set the ship up in just the right way?
Listen, I mean, I, again, Mark and the early team there were incredibly smart, you know, beyond their years, savvy, really good listeners. I think this, you know, Facebook has been a listening culture from the beginning. Mark is amazing in that his kind of listen to talk ratio is probably 4-1. which can be unnerving but powerful, right? And he's just a, you know, he listens. And I think that for me, it was, how can I build a culture around the things that matter to me? Humble partnership, transparency, trust, honesty, empathy. And it had been part of the DNA of Facebook, you know, on, you know, at company-wide, but particularly in the sales and marketing side, you know, from the beginning.
What do you look back and think their crown jewel was at the time? And then what is it now? And then I'm curious, like, when you look at your career there, what has been the place that you put your flagpole in and say, you know, I feel pretty good about making this influence in this company?
Yeah, I think, listen, being part of a mission-driven company who's...
So that got you going early.
Yeah, to me, I mean, that's everything. And yeah. There's other ways to run companies. There are companies that aren't mission-driven, right? They're process driven companies,
or bottom line,
right?
Driven, or
well,
whatever.
They're process driven, right? Mm-hmm. They say, okay, we have a way of doing things that we can apply to a lot of different things. You know, Facebook's mission was to do that thing, to make the world more open and connected, and that was the filter by which we did everything, you know, that we did. And we felt that connecting people to brands was as important as connecting people to those in their lives that matter to them. So I think being mission driven and thinking in the terms of mission, strategy, and tactics, which is the way I always kind of think about things, is powerful. So to me, that structure, and I also realized, and Mark was very open about it when we first met. Mark and a guy named Matt Kohler, who's a really dear friend of mine and a great venture capitalist now in Silicon Valley. You know, that this was either, we were either going to change the world or it was going to be over quickly, right? Which were like, those are the two best outcomes. You're going to be part of something that's mighty and powerful, or you're going to go down guns blazing quickly.
So how does that happen? How do you know, like, does that mean that you're going to place big bets, that you're going to put a lot of resources in one place, or like, why would it go down blazing? True.
Well, I think, you know, you know, again, there are these companies at the time, there were companies that were, you know, just kind of like, you know, circling the drain for a long, long time. And that wasn't of interest to me or to anybody else there. We were going to it was going to be big and meaningful, you know, on all levels. And I'm not talking about just revenue, just we were going to be impactful, right? We're going to change the world kind of stuff, you know, or we were going to get out of the game.
How involved are you now?
Very. I mean, that's my, you know, again, yeah. I really feel like right now I'm doing the most impactful, meaningful, you know, enjoyable work that I've done in all the time I've been there in my whole career.
Okay. What does that process look like for you to make your work be meaningful? Like, how do you do that? That's the stuff I want to learn. Like, I have no idea what your day-to-day rhythms look like, or week-to-week, or month-to-month. So how do you create that meaningful engagement on a day-to-day basis?
So the stuff, I mean, it doesn't matter what I'm working on. Like, I take an approach to it that I, you know, there's a Japanese, I spent a lot of time in Japan in the last 4 years, I think 13 or 14 trips in the last four years,
goodness.
You know, on Facebook Business, and I love it there.
Which parts?
And Tokyo, Kyoto. I've been out in the boonies, and, you know, my wife has learned to speak, you know, passable enough Japanese that we can
really
explore. Yeah, it's great.
Have you been to Mount Hiei?
No, yeah. I haven't.
Do you want to?
Yes. I want to know as much about Japan and explore parts of Japan as, you know, yeah, as I can. And I love it. But there's this idea, this shokunin, which mm-hmm. is this, you know, I guess a direct translation is kind of craftsman or artisan, mm-hmm. but I don't think that really captures it all. It's more about being the best version of yourself and being the best at doing whatever you're doing at the moment that you're doing it. And I think I try to extend that and say, try to be a little bit better every day. So to me, it's like, I just want to be a little bit better today than I was yesterday at the things that I'm doing. And to me, that's inspiring.
And yeah, it is. And because that process is something that you can potentially master on a regular basis. Like,
yeah,
you know, like, I don't know if we ever really master it, you know, but the idea that I can get better at this thing that I'm doing, whatever this is, what are you working on now? Like, what are some of the skills that you're working on?
Yeah, I mean, for like personally, I think, you know, from a, you know, a culture standpoint, you know, I think that's really important as we kind of spread our culture at Facebook. We have got really, you know, kind of key core values that, you know, kind of really inform, you know, kind of who we are. And the company's growing fast. I mean, you know, 50% of our employees have been there 18 months or less. And that will continue for the foreseeable future. And so as
that's
you grow,
a high turnover.
How well, no, we're not turning over. We're just adding people.
Oh, you're adding.
Yeah.
So
no, these are not
leaving.
People leaving. These are people.
Oh,
this
God.
Is all adding.
Oh, my God.
So maintaining that culture and being able to kind of thread that cultural DNA.
Okay. I love this. How do you do that? How do you, is it an onboarding? Is it something that takes place where they can learn, or are you pre-selecting for people that have
We're really good at the onboarding, right? We do, and we're rigorous about onboarding and, you know, making sure that people understand kind of what we stand for, and getting hired is a rigorous process.
It is
there as well. But I think, you know, again, I think a lot of it comes through leadership and through action. You know, I think you can't tell somebody what the culture is. You need to see people acting in a way. And we've got, you know, being part of a listening culture, you know, means that a lot of times we have hard conversations, and we really, you know, Sheryl Sandberg has talked about this, and, you know, and publicly, that this idea of having hard conversations and putting stuff on the table early, you know, can be uncomfortable, but it's the way you kind of cut through a lot of the bullshit and you get people kind of focused on what are the right things. And I'm very much a water under the bridge guy, and I don't hold grudges. And if I'll, you know, say, hey, listen, this isn't cool, this is not the way we do it, making people feel less than or othered in any way is not the way we operate, whether it's the way you talk to a client or the way you talk to a cross-functional partner or the way you talk to a peer, not cool. And I want you to know that. You know, I'm not your father, I'm not your boss, but I'm a colleague, and I just want you to know that's not the way we operate. And those conversations at all levels of the company, you know, we encourage people to have those hard conversations often.
You have a unique vantage point on what you've come to see as a global footprint in modern day technology. Like, it's really unique, your point of view. And you're saying culture is one of the greatest accelerants at Facebook. And what you just described is the relationships between people. So you've inoculated, it sounds like, arrogance. People being condescending to each other. And so you're inoculating it by saying, no.
That's not how we operate.
That isn't, okay.
Yeah, and listen, I learned that early in my, you know, like I said, I told you my experience at News Corp was not a, you know, that was not a political environment. And I've never seen people actually get ahead by being political. You know, and I always think that, you know, and listen, it doesn't matter where, what company, what you're doing, people tend to think about their bosses more than their bosses think about them. You know, and people generally are not, you know, their boss doesn't have an epiphany and then you're fired. It's usually the way you treat those who work with you and for you. And I think the beautiful thing right now, and I being the father of 23-year-old daughters, I think the world right now, the era of bullies and assholes is over, and people don't settle for being treated in a way that early in my career was like, that's just, you put up with it, right? And I think I'm very proud and happy that we have a culture at Facebook that allows people to not be in that kind of environment. People choose their leaders at Facebook. So your boss may not be your leader. You always want your boss to be your leader, but it may not be. And people look for those North Stars, and they look at people's actions and how they want to, you know, kind of live their life and interact with those around them.
So you have extraordinary relationships as well. Like, you have been able to meet people that have done amazing things. Right. And can you walk through like how that comes to be for you? And I'm talking about global thinkers and doers that are extraordinary what they do.
Yeah. And listen, I think being intellectually curious is, you know, matters. I mean, like, yeah. You know, listen, I watched the Tony Robbins documentary, and I had no context for Tony Robbins as a person. And I watched it, I think it was a Netflix documentary. And I watched it with my mom and my wife and like three generations here, right? Because we're big gaps for all three of us. And we were all just completely, like, we were pretty spellbound by him and this documentary. And so I called a friend of mine. As soon as it was over, I called a friend of mine who I know knows him. I said, I got to meet him. I got to meet this guy. Like, no agenda. Like, I just want to meet him because this is powerful stuff. And so I did. And he's like, and he was like, you know, kind of exceeded expectations.
And then is that a pattern that you have in your life that you've come connected to some idea or a concept or a person? And then you say, somehow I want to meet that person.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not like, you know, some cleat chaser, like that wants to, you know, that, you know, yeah. Like,
no,
I'm
not
looking for
all.
Pelts. Right. You know, but I, you know, I like interesting people that have a point of view. And, you know, I think, particularly around storytellers, you know, I've got, you know, the Alan Hughes discussion around Defiant Ones. I mean, it's an amazing, that's like kind of his, you know, an amazing body of work in that that's Apocalypse Now, right? Mm-hmm. For Alan Hughes. And we become friends because of that. We really kind of, we met, we bonded over our chat at CES this year. And he's just a really interesting guy with great and a great storyteller and has unbelievable perspective about being in LA at a time that was an important time in LA. I mean, he learned kind of, you know, how to kind of marketing, filmmaking and storytelling from Eazy-E. I mean, he had his summer of Eazy-E, you know, where he, you know, rolled around in a all white BMW, you know, 750 or 850 and like around LA. And that's how he learned storytelling. So, you know, and he worked, you know, with Tupac and he has a great perspective. Lena Waithe, same thing. I said, wow, this is an amazing person. You know, I don't know if you've seen the Thanksgiving episode of Master of None. It may be the best.
I haven't seen that.
It's an amazing 30 minutes of television. It's basically Lena's coming out story, but it's told in such an amazing way. It's such an important, poignant moment in television that I think I can only imagine how thankful so many people were for that, you know, to have her provide a voice to people who haven't had a voice before. Mm. So those are the kind of people I care about. You know, I think that, again, interesting points of view, care about things, are passionate.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Ritual. They are a supplement company. They just care about what they're doing. They are flat out committed. And they've got this idea that Ritual is made traceable, which means that their products are made with a visible supply chain so that you can see exactly what they're doing, their key ingredients, the supply chain, the research, the whole thing. For companies that are showing you exactly what's on the inside, exactly how they're doing it so that you know and feel comfortable knowing what you're consuming, I think it's a really nice touch. I think it's required. I think they are setting the standard for supplement companies. The product that I'm using right now that I flat out love is their Symbiotic. It's a 3-in-1 gut health supplement that, you know, microbiome is really important. So I need it. I think that you might benefit from it too, but of course I don't know. Go check out what they're doing. And it just gives me this peace of mind knowing that this is a company, this is a brand that doesn't cut corners. If you haven't had the chance to listen to our Finding Mastery episode with Ritual's founder, Katarina Schneider, I really want to encourage you to go check that out. It's episode 428. She's awesome. It's a fascinating conversation where Kat beautifully describes her story and Ritual's mission. They are investing in their company's quality so that you can invest in the quality of your life. So I want to encourage you to head over to ritual.com/mastery to get 25% off your first month of Ritual. And that's where you can get started on their subscription model. Again, this one's just a little different. It's ritual.com/mastery for 25% off.
What do you do to protect yourself against fatigue? Because you're ripping and running.
Yeah, I'm a big, you know, I'm a big hacker, life hacker, so it's my Whoop band that I have on my bicep.
How long have you been using the technology?
Yeah, about 3 months. My friend Tony Bertone, who's been involved with the company from the beginning, he's an old friend of mine. and told me about it, you know, in the early days. And like, I didn't, you know, I kind of didn't want more stuff. Like there's like, I don't like things you have to charge. Right.
Yeah.
I want
the friction on that can be overwhelming.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
I don't like the overhead. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And well, this just felt like, okay, this is a cool thing. And I like the whole idea of kind of, you know, being able to kind of measure like, you know, kind of data, kind of data centric. And I like being able to measure stuff. So I really like, I was gone for 2 weeks and didn't take it with me because I didn't want to carry the charger with me and I missed it. And now I have to build up my whole thing again.
You know, yeah, there is a psychology. Like, I don't know. I look. One of the early things I do in my mornings is take a look.
How'd you do?
Yeah, how'd I do? Right. And then I'll send screenshots and texts to my buddies about like I kicked your ass
winning
on sleep. Yeah. Or like my strain metric was high.
So. No, I mean I there was a company called Zio in like the early days of
this. I remember. Yeah.
They had like a headband.
Yeah.
Which was really creepy. And I wore the Zio
headband.
Would
you sleep
for
with
a
it?
While. Yeah, I'd sleep with that, you know, but I had, it's interesting because I had, yes, kind of how I do it, but, or how I can manage it. You know, I was having trouble, like all of a sudden, you know, 3 years ago, I was having sleep problems where I could fall asleep quickly and I would wake up 2 hours to the minute from when I went to sleep. If I went to bed at 10, I'd be up at midnight. If I went to bed at 11, I'd be up at 1. And it wouldn't last long, but I'd just be up for, I'd wake up. And I'd be like, you know, try to avoid solving the world's problems so I could go back to sleep. And so it'd be like 15 minutes.
But that's a skill, actually, to recognize that your mind's about to jump on a hamster wheel and then get off it.
Yeah, that's a slippery slope for me.
Do you get out of bed or would you stay in bed?
No, I'll stay in bed. Like once that's, you know, kryptonite, right? If you get out of bed, then, you know.
No, for me, it actually resets. So if I'm sleeping in bed and I just get caught thinking, I'm like, wait, hold on. I got to reset this thing. I get out of bed. I'll just take like a little lap around my room and then go back in.
No, so that's you know, so I had this thing and it would go on. I'd wake up 3 times a night. And it was awful.
Brutal.
Awful. And so
Sleep disorder.
Yeah. So I was talking and like it was crazy because it was every 2 hours. It was like to the minute. Right? And so I was talking to my doctor who's a very old school internist, but very modern and Eastern in the way that he thinks. And he said, you should go talk to this hypnotherapist I know. And I said, well, that sounds, you know,
weird,
right? But, right, yeah. But okay. Like,
but there's something super powerful.
So I went and saw this great hypnotherapist named Cynthia Morgan. Mm-hmm. And I went and saw her and told her what my issue was. And she said, I can deal with that. And I saw her, you know, it's, again, what's nice about that, it wasn't like, it's not like chiropractic where you have to kind of, it's like forever. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like, okay, like in five sessions, we can like sort this out. And so she made me recordings that are on my iPhone. And I've listened to those recordings thousands of times. I can't tell you anything on any of those recordings beyond close your eyes, take 3 deep breaths, and then I'm out.
It works.
And
it's working for
it
you.
It cured my this I don't know if it's insomnia or this like waking up problem that now I sleep through the night. And if I feel like, oh my God, like it's gonna happen, I just listen to one of her tapes and
That intellectual curiosity thing is there for you again because you have a pattern of pushing against some cultural accepted practices and hypnosis is not, right? That's not, most people would say take medication, you know, they backfill a lot of other things before they'd say go to a hypnotherapist. So you've got a counterculture way about you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm open to like, you know, any and all ideas.
What kind of music do you listen to?
You know, like I'm a old school hip hop guy. I went through years. Like
you,
I had to listen.
You don't look like an old school hip hop guy
you know, it's funny because like I went for probably a 10-year period where I had to listen to some Biggie every day. Mm. And you know, then I would get in these huge.
What is it about it? That music.
And I was vindicated by if you've seen the Biggie documentary about what an amazing kind of person he was, you know, and a real lyricist, you know, at a time. He and Tupac died in their early 20s. I mean, these guys did not have long lives. You know, amazing lyricist, amazing storyteller. That, you know, with an amazing mom, by the way, part of the story that I had never known. But no, I think that, you know, again, there was, you know, a lot of that early hip hop was, I think, incredibly melodic. A lot of the stories incredibly poignant. You know, and I think that a lot of current hip hop is pretty lazy. And I think that there was a moment there where it mattered. Mm. So,
okay. Instagram, your relationship there.
Instagram is, you know, again, you know, this amazing company that we bought that I've embraced as, you know, I think it's just a fantastic tool. You know, giving people a visual language mm-hmm. with which to talk. I think now with stories, you know, which has become such a huge use case for so many, you know, people on Instagram, that giving people these tools to tell stories, you know, often anonymously. And you think about how radical that was. I mean, you remember it wasn't that long ago that people say, I'm not putting pictures on the internet. I don't want anybody to see my privacy. Pictures on the internet. Yep. Instagram is based on putting pictures on the mm-hmm. internet. You know, it's very interesting in places like Japan, you know, where there isn't a culture. Japan doesn't have like a show and tell culture, right? You would never, as a child in Japan, go in front of your class and share, you know, the shell you found on your vacation. That just doesn't exist. So this idea of sharing anonymously on Instagram is incredibly powerful.
Why do you say anonymously?
Because you don't have to use your real identity.
Yeah, you don't have to. And yeah. A lot of people do,
and a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
And a lot of people follow people they don't know.
There's an anonymity there right. as well.
Yeah, I think that it's just powerful. I'm a photographer, and I've been a photographer for, you know, forever. And I love imagery, and I love being able to tell stories in whether in a still image or in a short video clip. And that's powerful to me.
Where do you think Instagram is going?
You know, so I think the iteration that team is doing on a product standpoint has been powerful. And we launched IGTV, which is a new kind of, you know, watch surface. And it's a platform where people can create long form video.
All right. So yeah, good. So Facebook, Instagram, Birdwell.
Yeah, Nelson, you know, again, as I said, my dad wore Birdwells. You know, the company was started in 1961. Birdwells are what I wore.
It's a surf brand.
Yeah,
for folks, it's a
surf
brand. It's
the last surf trunks made in America.
Yeah. Are they really?
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like there's a classic look to Birdwells.
Yeah,
they're a little short, right?
It's funny because we make them in three lengths for guys.
I would never have known that.
Yeah, we had three lengths, and the shorter length is actually our most popular length now.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, the real beauty of Birdwell, listen, it took me 15 years to get that brand. You know, we chased that brand from my really good friend and business partner, Nadas Kappas. I was an ex-pro skater, invented the Ollie, and just a mm-hmm. really great guy. And he and I worked together at Quiksilver, and we were in Hong Kong, and we were like musing on, God, if you could own a brand, what would it be? And we both said Birdwell. And so we spent from that day forward trying to figure out a way to get that brand.
So how'd you get it?
You know, we
waited.
Through persistence, right? There was a guy early on who was a business school colleague of a Facebook colleague of mine. And said, I wanted to be in the surf industry. I said, you really don't. Unless you could own Birdwell. And he's like, you know, I get it. And I said, well, if you can figure out how to get him to sell it, we'll figure out how to buy it. And he was relentless. He went kind of weekly for a year, and one day was the day, and that was
it. Are you guys partners?
He's now left. He was our first CEO, and the business started scaling very, very fast. And
Is it mostly online now?
Yes. We took that business from a wholesale business to, you know, 90% direct to consumer.
What I love about it is like you can go online and customize your gear, right? You can say, I want my stripes this way or that way. I want my stripes to be this color or that color.
A button or patch. And,
yeah.
You know, that's, and, you know, you again, Jeff Clausen is the CEO of Birdwell now, who is a guy I'd hired at Facebook 10 years ago and is a fantastic operator. You know, he had run a lot of the online business for WAMU and then JP Morgan Chase, and I recruited him to Facebook, and he did amazing work there and got involved with Birdwell originally with me. And then we were looking for a new CEO, and he raised his hand and said, I'm the guy to do it. And, you know, we've taken that business, and he has taken that business to, you know, unbelievable levels. When we first bought the company, there were weeks and months when that factory was open one day a week. And we had employees that had been there for 40 years that were still hanging in there on one day a week. And now we're working double shifts. So, you know, it's fantastic. And from an operational excellence standpoint, you know, things like being able to customize product, if you listen to like Warren Buffett talks about building a moat around your business, customization is a moat for the Birdwell business because it's something that a foreign made brand can't do.
You can't.
You can't do it. But when you're making stuff in Santa Ana in the same factory we've been in and you want to add a button or a stripe or a patch to your product, you know, and we'll ship it, you know, within 2 days. That's pretty special.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's, you know, it's been really good. And listen, it's also, you know, if we knew anything as kind of people, we knew the online business and we knew that e-commerce could be powerful. And we knew the relationship with a direct relationship with customers by not being disintermediated by retail for what we were selling mattered. And I think we were unique in that you either knew of Birdwell and loved it or you never heard of it. And so it didn't have any, there was no hair on the brand, right?
Yeah. So in the surf world, I think people recognize it, but outside of the surf world, you know, it might be a new thought.
Yeah, no, it isn't. The thing that's amazing is how, you know, popular the brand is not in this thin line of coast around the country. You know, states like Virginia and Texas, you know, are our biggest, some of our biggest states. And I think for a lot of people, I mean, the fact that we make, you know, again, it's a mission-driven company making purpose-built, high-quality product that's guaranteed for life. I mean, you tell someone your bathing suit is guaranteed for life, you know, that's meaning. And we know from 57 years of making this product, you can't wear this stuff out. Mm. And so for a lot of people, $79 or $89 or $99 is a considered purchase, right? And I think for some people, you know, this is, it's justified by the fact that these don't wear out. And it says something about, I mean, you know, we were lucky. I think Men's Journal referred to them as the 501s of the beach. And like, that's the way I like to think of them, right? It's like a miner buying a pair of Levi's, you know, that for, if you're a waterman, if you're a lifeguard, if you're a surfer, a paddler in Hawaii, you know, that Birdwells are a tool. Mm.
How do you finish this thought? My philosophy is
to be the best part of another person's day.
Where does that live in you when you say that?
That, and listen, that's to me, like you think about it, those are the things I like, that's one of the things I meditate on, right? I think,
but where,
about,
where did that just happen for you? Because you just said it and I felt everything you just said.
No, I think about that all the time.
Yeah.
And when I manage teams at Facebook, you know, one of the KPIs, you know, that we had for, you know, for their review was be the best part of another person's day. You know, and it's the advice I give people all the time, make you a better father, it'll make you a better son, it'll make you a better employee, employer. It's just a good life lesson. And, you know, it's really, to me, I want my interactions to be positive, you know, and to have positive impact on the people I come in touch with.
How come?
That's why I want my legacy to be.
That you made a difference in others.
Yeah, that I, you know, that I care.
Deep in few or across many?
Anybody. Like, you know, I'm.
And where does that live? I'm going to say that. I want to ask that again. Where does it live inside of you? Do you feel it in your heart, in your stomach, in your chest, in your body, in your throat, in your, behind your eyes?
Like, yeah, where, I mean, it's not, listen, again, it's not lip service, right? It's
right. Because I mean, when you said it, I could see it and feel it.
Yeah, no, it's really true. I mean, I think to me, that's like the greatest gift you can give somebody is to be a great part of their day, you know? And it doesn't mean like, you know, it doesn't mean that kind of, you know, being like sappy or, you know, it doesn't mean that. It means being genuinely interested, engaged, you know, coming with solutions, not problems. You know, when people see you come into the room, you know, you maybe bring an answer instead of a question. You know, that, listen, everybody's busy. And so I encourage people all the time, say, listen, just, you know, if you're going to focus on one thing, be the best part of another person's day.
That's pretty rad. I've never heard anybody say that.
Yeah, I don't really know where, like how I started thinking
that
about
rad.
That.
Yeah,
that but really it, cool. But it's a, listen, it's a good, like if somebody, like I told my daughters that, like, you know, I said, listen, you know, if you want to understand, like if you want to know like what I think when you go to work, and whether one's a dancer and the other has just graduated from school, and she was working at the Harvard Lampoon, which was like being part of a business at Harvard, and I said, just be the best part of your client's day, be the best part of your partner's day, you know, the people you work with.
So shifting gears, like, how do you think about confidence?
Yeah, I don't think of myself as being particularly confident.
You don't?
No.
More doubtful than confidence?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, and it's again, it's something, you know, that I meditate on. It's like, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, I want to be confident, but I don't want to be hubristic, right? And that's a hard one to kind of balance. And so I try to, you know, again, I feel like I've got a lot of self-doubt, you know, and I question, but I think it's healthy to question the kind of your decisions and vet my decisions. I admire people that are supremely confident and kind of own the room. And like, you just know when you listen and they know they're right. Like, that's not really, you know, not really who I am.
What do you do when you recognize doubt in your head?
I talk to people who I trust to get their point of view.
Okay. And then when there's no one around, what do you do with that thought? You know, those types of thoughts.
I will always err on the side of goodness.
Okay. So then as you're trying to figure out a decision, that's an easy model, like err on the side of doing good. But then how about when there's no decision, but you're just thinking about something?
I mean, you know, I guess thinking about something always, I need to think about it for a second, but I imagine that thinking about things always, there's always some outcome, right? You're going to have some action, you know, so there's usually probably a choice of actions, you know, and if I'm completely befuddled, I guess I would err on the side of goodness, yeah, okay, right? Good. But I can't think of like, oh, I was thinking about this thing and I had like this, you know, terrible thought and there was no other outcome other than like this one.
Except that one
thought.
And
like, you got to think about something else. But
is it hard to be in your head or easy to be in your own head?
No, I try to still my mind as much as possible.
What does your practice look like?
It's a daily meditation practice, you know, that isn't, again, you know, it's not, you know, hours. It's 20 minutes a day. It's the first thing I do when I get up. I think stilling your mind is powerful.
Yeah. And so is it non-judgmental awareness? Is it more of a focus training where you're breathing and focus on one thing? Is it both of them?
So it starts with the breathing meditation. You know, I used to, which was effective to me, and I stopped doing it because it was kind of counter to the stilling your mind part, is I would meditate often on things that were going to happen that day that I knew were going to happen. And I would think through it really was a form of visualization.
Performance imagery, yeah.
Right? That I would know. So when they happened, I would have already experienced it. And I would be able to kind of be more, I'd be wiser in what the outcome, you know, of that conversation would be.
Or at least have a target too.
Right.
And sensations are targets. So how long have you been doing that?
20 years. 20 years.
And then how'd you get exposed to it? Does this have some of the Eastern influence?
Yeah, I know. I just remember thinking it was interesting. I had those awful meditation tapes that I told you about.
Yeah.
You know, with the airplane in the background, you know, no headspace. But it was just, to me, it just feels right. You know, and then I was lucky. I found the Mahamudra Kadampa Buddhism Center here in South Bay. You know, is an amazing place. And Tangpa, who is the teacher there, is the monk who leads the practice.
Are you a practicing Buddhist?
I guess, you know, in spirit, you know, so for sure, you know, I have trouble always getting around the, you know, past, like, what was I in a past life?
Mm-hmm.
But I think most people do, like, mm-hmm. when you kind of are new to Buddhism. But again, it's more to me a practice of how I kind of want to live. I think these ideas of ridding myself of self-grasping ignorance and kind of not looking at the world from my own belly button all the time. And, you know, one of the hardest lessons that I think about all the time is, you know, separating yourself from actions that your thoughts aren't real, right? They're just thoughts. And, you know, you kind of think that you have superpowers, like when you think something that's true. And so separating yourself from those thoughts is mighty. My wife is very good at doing that and has been very good at encouraging me to do that.
If we were able to measure and observe thoughts one day, let's just say we could actually see thoughts, and then we could have this basic tally at the end of the day, positive, negative, productive, destructive, whatever, like labels we put on it, but thoughts that create goodness and thoughts that get in the way of goodness, or even worse than that, right? So where would you imagine you are on that scale? Is it 80-20? Is it 70-30? Is it 50-50? You know, is it actually worse than you think it is sometimes?
No, I try to, you know, again, I always assume good intent, right? And so if I'm faced with somebody or something that feels like not right, mm-hmm. like a really good way around that is to assume good intent. And so if I can embrace that and I try to embrace empathy, then I understand, like, you know what, like, it's not like the story in my head. Like, there's a great quote that I share all the time, which is, the thing that screws us up most in life is the story in your head of how it's supposed to be. And
God, I'm struggling with that right now with a relationship for sure.
You know, yes. But like, you have the story in your head, and it's very hard to break that. And so I remind myself of that all the time.
And so what do you do with that?
I think a lot of these tools that I talked about assume good intent. Mm-hmm. You know, try to be positive.
And what if that, I'm trying to be positive, I'm assuming best intent, but the patterns are not changing at all. And there's been communication that those patterns, like it's not working. The pattern of behavior is not working. And like, so how do you deal with that? If you've communicated to somebody that says, hey, listen, this isn't quite working. It's not the way that we would hope it would to be. It's not working for me. And they say, yes, 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 we'll do better. We'll do better. And that doesn't change.
Well, but you know, he's like, again, it's another kind of a Buddhist way of thinking about things is that I believe that everybody ultimately wants to be happy, but just a lot of people don't know how to get there. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think you can change people to, a lot of, I've seen
1,000%.
I've seen people change, which, and so I would say it's not impossible, but I think helping people find the path to what is it that you really want? Like, what is it? What are the things you think will make you happy? And let's figure out a way for you to get there, which is much better than arguing with somebody, whether they're right or they're wrong.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, everybody and every being wants to be happy. So and feel like self-actualized in some way. So,
okay. So morning practice, about 20 minutes. And is it time-based or is it state-based?
When it's over, it's over.
It's over for you. You've got some patterns where you're assuming goodness and you're erring on the side of goodness, like assuming best intent and erring on the side of goodness. And how about nutrition? How do you think about your nutrition?
No, I think about it a lot. I think I've told you before, and I haven't shared it, but I'm a pancreatic cancer survivor. So I you know, luckily it's been, 12 years. So, I'm kind of way on the other side of that. Mm. But
congratulations.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And diet was, really important. I had what's called a Whipple procedure, which is a complicated operation that, kind of screws up a lot of your, intestinal transit. And so being careful about what I've eaten, what I eat is important. I worked with Chris Talley, who I know is a friend of yours, mm-hmm. Who really helped me kind of get, my arms around that. And, I try to be smart, in how I eat. I'm one of the few people you meet in LA who is actually gluten intolerant, not because it's fashionable. Yeah. I've changed the way I eat, a lot because of that. And that's been amazing.
And it's like for real, you've been using Athletic Greens as well.
Yeah, I have been. Yeah. I actually think that Chris the Kiwi is like the greatest. And I know you have a relationship with him, but like he is absolutely the greatest online marketer. And people ask me who is a great online, relationship marketer. Chris the Kiwi.
He's done a great job, hasn't
he? It's unbelievable.
Yeah, but his product has value. Value. It's solid.
Yeah. I it almost tastes too good to be like, so sometimes I'll say it can't be that good because it tastes too good, relative to what other,
well, it doesn't taste like a strawberry banana shake,
but it tastes better than like Green Vibrance, which I've also drank, which I think has to be good for you because it doesn't taste good at all.
So. Yeah. No. And the micro macronutrients inside of it are solid. Like they've done their job. Did you enjoy Chris's conversation on the podcast?
Yes.
Yeah, wasn't that fun?
Yeah.
He did a great job.
Unbelievable. Yeah. No, both Chris's. Chris Talley as well, the gentle giant.
Yeah.
He's unbelievable. So.
Yeah. Does he make your food for you?
He has in the past. And I think, not anymore. I travel a lot. And so.
That's what happens to me. I've been flow there too.
Yeah. And I always had that moment where it's like, like you come home and like there's four things in there you haven't eaten. And you're like, oh, I feel so guilty. So, no. But I learned a lot from him. But I'm a creature of habit. Like I'm like, people think that dogs want to eat different things all the time. Dogs want to eat the same thing all the time. I'm like a dog. I eat the same. I'm happy eating the same stuff all the time.
Okay. So sleep matters. Eating matters. Your thinking structure is about doing good and erring on that side. And you've got a clear philosophy. You've got your mission minded and have a very clear vision for the future. And I want to articulate that in a minute. Optimism. Is that an important variable for you?
Yeah. I'm an optimist.
Flat out.
Yeah, I'm an optimist.
You don't hesitate.
No, I mean, listen, and there are moments that get shaken, right? I think the mm-hmm. world is a complicated place right now, and there are moments you can get sucked in and feel, pessimistic easily. But I am an optimist, and that's the only way I can try to operate, because again, it's a slippery slope, because you will find all kinds of people who will help you go the other way, right? People are great enablers of pessimism. So
when I talk about optimism and pessimism, I can feel it. I'm an optimist as well.
Right.
And, You know, there's lots of trainings that you can do if you're struggling with pessimism or doubt, or, you know, that can help you be more optimistic on a regular basis. But I can feel it when I talk to people about it. And there's this eye rolling thing like, oh, here we go. Like, here's the soft conversation coming. What, are we supposed to all hold hands too?
Yeah, but again, it's back to that kind of basic, you know, the basic Buddhist tenet of like, all people want to be happy and they just don't know how to get there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if, you know, I call it kind of the over the cliff bear hug, right? You know, people have like an idea and they want you to become part of that idea, and it can be a negative idea. And if you don't embrace it, like, they want to take you down with them, right? There's like strength in numbers in doing that. And so I try to avoid the over the cliff bear hug.
This is, I think, a relatively tough question, but how do you define high performance as a human? High performance as a human.
I mean, again, I think it goes back to those basic things. I want to be the best part of another person's day. I want to be a little bit better at the things I do every day. And that's high performance to me. You know, it's not
about, what if the output is not world class or world leading or even regionally significant?
So, I mean, I don't think I've done anything that is world leading, regionally significant, but I'm incredibly at peace with the things I do. I'm proud of my interactions with others. I'm proud of the impact I've had on the people that I work with and have come into contact with. I think mentoring, you know, is really important to me. And I think I've made positive impact, you know, in formal mentoring as well as informal. And so that's a way, I mean, that's the scorecard. It's not like, you know, did I win an award? It's certainly not money, you know, because I think that's, again, it's just a tool.
You know, that's what I wanted from you in this experience, is to celebrate the soul of you. You're an intellectual, like, you think deeply and critically, but your soul is
of a surfer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Right. But there's something really charming about the way that you care and that you can think critically. And when we first met, I was like, I want to go further.
Nah, thank you. Yeah. No, listen, coming from you, that's is a huge compliment. Because
thank you.
I mean, you know, again, it's humbling to look at the list of people you've talked to and that you work with. And, you know, again, I'm an okay surfer, a middling athlete, you know, but I'm healthy and I'm able to do the things I want to do. And I'm stoked to, like, you know, I love the stuff I'm doing.
I think you're onto something, though. All of that, yes. And having a massive impact, you know, as employee less than 10. Is there a number?
Eight.
Employee number 8 at Facebook. I mean, come on. And then influencing, the influence you've had on Instagram as well. And I don't know the size of that, but I just know that from reputation that you've had an influence.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then being able to carve up a brand that, you know, like, you fell in love with early days.
Yeah, like, no, please. that's been really, yeah. It's so great to own a business and see, you know, employ people and have a great team there. You know, the team that runs that business is mighty.
Okay. Last couple of questions. What is your definition, or how do you articulate mastery?
I guess, you know, again, it comes back. You've asked that same question a couple of different ways. For me, you know, it's about the journey, not the destination. And so for me is, you know, am I doing better today than I did yesterday and whatever it is that I'm working on? Did I leave things better than I found them? Did I have a positive influence? And did I make a positive influence? Was I a better part of somebody's day than they normally would have had?
So where can folks follow you? I want to say Birdwell, because everyone listening is on Facebook and engaging on a regular basis, and Instagram.
Yeah, listen, my Instagram is my jam. I mean, like I said, I'm a photographer, and so I love my Instagram account, and I try to curate it well, and I think it speaks to a lot of my passions. And so
what's the handle again?
MFJ20TH. So, and I'll tell you where that comes from. When I was at Fox, this in the early days before we had corporate email, I set up an email account for the people in the television division on AOL. So my AOL, so everybody was their initials 20th@AOL.com.
20th.
Yeah. For 20th Century Fox.
Right. Yeah.
So I kept my MFJ 20th is my handle.
And then birdwell.com.
Yeah. So you can go to birdwell.com and look at what the guys are doing there. And yeah, you know, it's good stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your soul. Thank you for your critical thinking. Thank you for being able to unpack the clarity of what drives you. And there's no doubt that it's about doing good for the world.
Yeah, thank you.
Doing good for others.
Yeah, so. I hope so. That's why I hope people feel that way.
Yeah, cool.
Better than the alternative.
Yes. And everyone, thank you for listening. Thank you for paying attention to what we're doing here. You can find us on Instagram at Finding Mastery. You can find us on my Instagram as well as Michael Gervais. Do you know about our tribe?
No.
Have you? Oh, it's on Facebook, on using your platform. And we've got thousands and thousands of people that are supporting and challenging each other on a regular basis on the tribe. It's unbelievable.
Fantastic. Like
they've took this community and lit it up. And it's so Facebook has done a great job for us there as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.